Let's go.
You're listening to Making Data Simple, where we make the world of data effortless, relevant, and yes, even fun.
Hi, folks. Welcome to Making Data Simple. I hope everybody is well. Happy holidays to all of you. Today, I'm with Casper Willstrup, who is the founder, CEO of Abzu. Did I get that right? No,
yes,
not really.
That sounded okay. Very, very right. There's something with the A quality that needs to be quite perfect. It's a Sumerian word, so we can all make up our own assumption about how it sounded, but I think it worked well.
Well, I probably didn't get it perfectly right, but anyway, I do my best. And we'll talk about the meaning of that Sumerian word. Just to give a quick introduction to Casper, I'm going to use your LinkedIn definition because I really liked it. And it starts with an optimist, an advocate of transparent AI. Look, we need more optimists in the world. So hopefully you're going to lighten us, give us some energy today. An optimist, an advocate for transparent AI, the inventor of Q-Lattice Symbolic AI. And as I mentioned, he's the CEO of Abzu. And Abzu drives the development and innovative trustworthy AI solutions. They combine logical reasoning with explainability for powerful and understandable AI applications. And they focus on symbolic AI, which I want to chat about, which is, well, this is the way I'll define it, focuses on the processing and manipulation of symbols or concepts rather than numerical data. Maybe more important than that, it's not just predictions and answers, it's about explainability. Now I'm going to turn it over to Casper. Welcome. Great to talk with you today. Please introduce yourself. Give us some of your experience. This is your time to boast. And what brings you to Abzu and how you ended up there and what's your mission in the world today?
Great. And thank you so much for having me here. I'll be looking very much forward to today. Right. When I start relaying my life story, it can get very long. I'll try to keep it moderately long. But it actually starts way back in the 80s when I was a small kid, and I 11 year old in 1981. And I got my hands on my first computer ever, or as I thought about it, a typewriter that could be connected to a television screen, and then you could do awesome things. And I immediately fell in love with the idea of computers. And to me, computers at that time also meant artificial intelligence. Alan Turing wasn't that far in the distance back then. So AI and computing was closely intertwined, at least in a science fiction nerd that I also was. I spent the majority of my youth actually programming on very primitive machines as it was, and I fell more and more in love with the idea of trying to build computers that can mimic human behavior. Then I ended up studying physics rather than computer science. I think that made more sense in the early 90s. It seemed like a more stable career. During my physics physics years, I got very involved with building the Linux kernel and also high-performance computing and various aspects of physics simulation. So manipulating enormous amounts of data and trying to make sense of that was essentially where the direction I took in my career. Then in 99, I did my first startup company. It was a new idea to do startup companies in Scandinavia at the time. We were a little behind the US, but I was one of the first people who took the jump into that in the Danish ecosystem, at least. But that startup company made hardware for high-performance computing to allow us to build supercomputing clusters to simulate various problems and solve various types of problems originally within quantum physics. And that has shaped my career since then. I've been in a lot of startup companies. I also worked a lot with various VC companies on assessing and investing in early stage startup companies in the Nordics, and jumped on board with a few of the companies that I helped decide to invest in over the years, all related to AI or data analytics. And then in 2018, I founded Abzu, and the idea with Abzu was exactly to get symbolic AI back into the foreground, because at the time a category of AI called subsymbolic AI had gotten to be and still is dominant, and the vision for me in creating the company Abzu was to try to breathe some life back into symbolic artificial intelligence. So that has been the mission of Abzu for the last 6 years, to develop and later on, once we made things work, also bring some of these symbolic AI methodologies to market.
Fantastic. We got a lot to talk about. First off, with your background in physics, no quantum in there? I mean, I'm surprised you're not starting a quantum startup or something.
Well, there is a little bit of quantum in what we're doing. It's not quantum computing. So today, a lot of people, at least in the tech field, who hear the word quantum, thinks quantum computers. And I don't and have never worked with quantum computers. It's entirely true. I played quite a bit with some of them over the years, and I have friends who work with quantum computing. What I worked with in the 90s was simulating quantum fields, trying to understand large collections of particles, how they actually behave, to understand the quantum reality of nature. And that was essentially the supercomputers that we built at the time were, the purpose of them was to study quantum fields. And when you do that, you use a method called quantum lattice gate simulations, where you chop up time and space in a strange and abstract matter, and then simulate space in a slightly different way. And then you can actually study quantum fields on computers. And that is actually also the core principle that underlies what we're doing at APSU. So the reason the technology that I've invented is called the Q-lattice is because it alludes to its origin in quantum lattice gate simulations. So to be fair, the Q-lattice algorithm is not a quantum lattice gate simulation algorithm. It's inspired by it. We've borrowed a lot of concepts from that idea, but it's also different in a number of ways. But it does have its origins in methodologies that were developed to study quantum fields.
Wow. You know, we call it making data simple. We just crossed out the simple. That's pretty deep stuff, man. Tell us a little bit about APSU. You know, where did the name come from, first of all? And you talked a little bit about it, but I think you're probably going to go into like more symbolic AI, but tell us more about the company itself.
Yeah, but let's start with the name. So the name is actually based on an ancient language called Sumerian, which was spoken in southern Mesopotamia, or Iraq, if you will, back 5,000 years ago. So the Sumerians were the people who invented writing. They wrote on clay tablets with cuneiform writing, like these little wedge-shaped things that you might have seen pictures of. Sumerian cuneiform is for some reason, it's a language that I've always been fascinated with. I guess it's because it's the most ancient language that is actually written down. So it's a snapshot into the past like no other language. The Egyptian hieroglyphs come close, I guess. So I actually taught myself to read Sumerian cuneiform during a sabbatical between a couple of startup companies. So I'm one of the strange nerds who read that language. And APSU is, in ancient Sumerian, in the earliest forms, it just means the underground water, the water that that is under the desert sands of what is now Mesopotamia. And the ancient Sumerians believed that there was a god down there called Enki who lived and governed the APSU realm. And that gradually converted into a full belief system. So APSU later came to mean other things as well. It also became a deity in its own right later. But to me, it means the underground water. The reason the company is called APSU is because while I was preparing to found it, I was actually building a prototype for this Q-lattice simulator. And I was building that in C. Following the naming convention, that's normal in C, in the C programming language, I called it LibAPSU. And then when I founded the company, I called it something else. It was actually called Machine Cognition Labs first. But my co-founders, the people that I convinced to join the company early on, had a look at those two names and said, no, we're going to call this company APSU. And I was a little against it to begin with. I don't really know why. I just felt, who can even say that? But they convinced me, and I guess I wasn't that hard to convince because I do love Sumerian. So we ended up calling the company APSU.
You're a man of many interests, I can already tell. That's awesome.
I lived a few years.
Same as me. I think we're about the same age, to be honest with you, after I hear your earlier stories. All right, so I got the name. Now the mission.
Yes. So the mission is, as I alluded to earlier, to bring symbolic AI back to life. A problem with a lot of the AI that's being built today is that it's really good at making decisions, perhaps, but it can never really justify how it arrives at those decisions. It just spits out either a prediction or a decision or some text, if we're talking generative AI. But the actual underlying reasoning process is not there. And the reason it's not there is because that's not how the systems are built. They're not built to reason first and then answer after. Symbolic AI, on the other hand, is actually not about predicting or even answering the question that you pose. It's more about figuring out a procedure to answer the question. And what we wanted to do with Apsu was to create a kind of AI, a new kind of AI, which was delivering on an old promise, the promise of symbolic artificial intelligence, but of course using new algorithms, but where the output of the AI is itself a procedure to answer a question and not the answer itself. So the analogy that I often use is, if you have a sub-symbolic AI, which is like the conventional approach to AI, if you have that kind of a system, say, predict where a planet will be, it might be very well good at predicting where Mars will be on the sky if you ask it the right question. But a symbolic AI, like our kind of AI, will not answer that question. It will instead generate Kepler's laws of planetary motion for you so that you can use those to answer the question. So the idea in symbolic AI is that you find a procedure to answer the question before you answer any question. And that gives it some very unique properties that I makes this AI system easier to understand and reason about, trust, and validate in various ways. So the vision that we were driven by was, let's build this kind of trustworthy, explainable AI that can really compete with the governing paradigm that I sometimes call the black box paradigm of artificial intelligence.
So here's the question I have right off the bat. First of all, like in the AI world today, I mean, it's going crazy. I don't need to explain that to you. But if I was to predict 2024, there are two things I think are going to be prevalent in 2024. And that is trustworthy AI, that with an emphasis on trust with all the things going on. I mean, like you've seen OpenAI can't even keep their CEO around. Why that debacle happened, there's all kinds of reasons. There's been trust, safety. There's other things that go into it as well. We got a ton of fake news. So I think trust is number one. Number two is just cost in general, in terms of keeping the cost reasonable relative to return on investment. And I work at IBM. And look, you know, we've got multiple different, you know, solutions, whether it's data fabric, automation, we sell power, storage, on and on. But I spend a lot of my days with AI. That's like our mission. Our mission is hybrid cloud and AI. Now we do have, this is about you, by the way, but I'll come back. But we do have explainability. We truly believe in that. In fact, product tracks, measures outcomes of the AI models. It helps them remain fair, explainable, and compliant. In other words, we want to open up the black box so you see how decisions are made. Now, having said that, we do give you the answer, and then we tell you how we got to that answer, because we want you to say, hey, look, this is computer science. Is that the same thing as your definition of symbolic AI? I see you shaking your head, so I didn't figure that was a case. That's why I wanted to lead in. You're looking at it a little bit differently with the procedure versus the answer, but you tell me. I'll shut up now.
I think, as you said, you're opening up the black box. But what you're saying there is also there is a black box to be opened up. There's no point in opening up a black box if there's no black box to begin with. And the problem with a lot of what people call explainable AI, what explainable AI has come to mean, is that you have an AI model, some kind of AI model, often a neural network, that you then study. You essentially try to examine how does this AI model behave under certain inputs. And then you can estimate what are the actual procedures, what are the actual things that goes into the decision making of this AI model. But you're essentially studying the behavior of the AI model. It's almost like animal behavior science, where you're trying to understand how the AI behaves, and then that becomes the explanation. But if there was never a black box to begin with, if the AI system that we talked about, instead of answering the question, generated a procedure that is capable of answering that question. And that procedure is formulated in a well-known so-called symbolic language, which we can talk more about what that actually means, but we can think about math or logic or flow diagrams of some kind. If the procedure to answer the question is symbolic in nature, then there never is a black box. It might be a black box AI that generates the procedure, but once the procedure is there, like say the diagnostic procedure for a medical app or a procedure to determine whether a customer can get credit. Once a procedure is there, it is completely white box. It's open and transparent because it's symbolic in nature. So symbolic AI is about that to me. It's about generating procedures that are simple and clear and deterministic enough that a human expert maybe can look at it and say, all right, this makes sense.
I got it, I think. But you may have to dive down further in that the use case, you're usually looking for that answer. We're human and flawed and just give me the answer. And yeah, sure. I want to make sure it's the trusted answer that I can see how you made the decision, but just give me the answer so I can move on. My customer wants to know X, Y, or Z. So I guess my question is give me the use case where the procedure comes first. You still get your answer and I'm able to get return on investment on this AI.
If I can stay in principle a moment, then we can talk about lots of use cases. Sure. But there's a way that I sometimes get the notion passed. Like you are in Kansas City, is that right?
I am in Kansas City, yes.
So if I were to ask you, I'm not going to, but if I were to ask you how many red cars are there in Kansas City, there are really two ways you could approach that question. Either you know, I guess you could also make up the answer, but since you are a symbolic reasoning human being, what you can do is you can actually write down a procedure to answer the question. So you could write down, I will start with the number of people who live in Kansas City, and then I will multiply that with the number of cars per person, and then I'll multiply that with the number of red cars per car, and then I have an answer. Right? So you could write that down, that procedure. That procedure is not the answer. Once you have it, I can then sample the population of Kansas City and the number of red cars and so on, and then I could test the procedure on a single data point. I could test it on, let's say, Denver or a few other cities that are kind of comparable, and then with, say, five cities or so, I can get a fairly good estimate of how accurate is your procedure at predicting the number of red cars in Kansas City. So the point here is what I end up with is a clear description of how to calculate the number of red cars in a city and a good estimate of the accuracy of that procedure. So that is very apart from what a machine learning approach would do. For to solve the same problem with a machine learning approach, you'd have to sample, say, a few thousand cities, a whole bunch of informations about each city, and then you could learn some kind of machine learning approach, gradient boosting approach or a neural network that could predict the number of red cars in any city. You would end up with a system that might be accurate, but which would be hard to explain. How do you arrive at the answer to the number of red cars in a city? So this contrasts the two ideas, and it also highlights the two specific features of symbolic AI that I consider important. One is the procedure is always understandable because it's written in a formal manner that a human can understand. Secondly, you can validate it on relatively little data. So from the point of view of the user, the feeling is, and that's, I know that a lot of people who use our technology have this weird, crazy experience that how can it learn this on only 10 patients or only 10 customers, or only 10 business cases? How can it actually learn it? But the answer is it's not learning the procedure from the data. It's hypothesizing the procedure and proving it on the data. And therefore, you can get those two, in principle, rather mind-blowing benefits of symbolic AI: clear explainability and learning, or at least the appearance of learning on very little data.
I understand what you're saying. I'm all around explainable AI. And like I said in my little pitch, is that I think trustworthy AI is going to grow in importance, particularly in the fake news we have in the world today. And I think we're only getting started. I say this all the time. People ask me what scares me about AI. It's absolutely not the Terminator. It's the fake news. I mean, the fake news and not knowing whether the answers are correct, where the answers came from, if they're hallucination, whatever. Is I kind of push you a little bit, or probe you a little bit. Isn't what you're talking about a little too theoretical? I mean, the reason we got here to begin with in the fake news is everybody just wants an answer. Just give me the answer and tell me it's accurate. And I want to be able to trust that answer is accurate. And if I don't trust you, then I'm going to go to somebody else that's going to give me the right answers. But in terms of coming up with a procedure, you know, Casper, do it in the background. Tell me it works. I want to trust you, IBM. I want to trust you, Abzu, whatever. And then I want to get my answer so my customer can, then I can move on and get other things done. What is your answer to that?
You're absolutely right. And we see the same thing. Most of our customers care about the answer. And for them, it's a hygiene factor. It's a nice thing that underlying this answer, there's a clear, explainable model. That can be because they have regulatory requirements that demand of them that they can justify the decisions. Maybe they're making diagnostic decisions in a medical setting. Maybe they're making credit decisions in a credit setting. So they care about the prediction or the answer, but they have some reason to also want the underlying explanation at least to exist. So we come across that very often. And as you started out with saying, I fundamentally operate from an optimist paradigm. So
yeah, you got that in your title.
Yeah. So what I do with symbolic AI is that I want to grow the green spots. I know that people want answers, but instead of trying to make laws and regulations to try to shovel away the desert, I want to offer a viable, even better alternative that will nudge people towards a transparent and explainable kind of AI. And I believe that the approach to symbolic AI that we're developing is actually delivering both better answers and the transparency, because otherwise it won't ever really, if we have to rely on people's good ethics or morals in order to choose an inferior but more transparent AI approach, I think that's going to be difficult. But symbolic AI and the flavor that I present actually is more accurate than the conventional approaches, exactly because it can be validated, or it can learn on very little data. So in many situations, we've seen that time and time again. People have like studied 19 patients with a specific disease, and our symbolic AI has been able to come up with good understanding of why these patients respond well to a drug. And again, for the customer, it might only matter whether they respond to the drug or not, but the underlying explanation is what makes it work in practice. And what makes it, in this case, also comply with legal requirements for diagnostic systems.
So are you characterizing your position then as, going back to the analogy we had earlier, rather than allowing a black box to be created and then going back into the black box to say, all right, how did it get to the answer? You're saying, I don't create the black box to begin with. I will give you the procedure that we've got to the answer. You know, I don't know. It's computer science. This is the statistical relevance, blah, 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 whatever. And then here's the answer.
Yes, exactly. And ironically, the procedure that you use to get the procedure to get to the answer, like that is in fact black box. So even in symbolic AI,
playing for the player.
Yeah, it takes a little time to get your head around. But the idea is that the AI does not directly give the answer. It first gives the procedure, and then the procedure gives the answer. So from the point of view of the user, this might not matter. You get the answer. But the important aspect is that the black box part is constrained to delivering the procedure that can answer the question, which means that when we start using these answers for whatever purpose we have, we also have a clear justification for how we get those answers.
Well, do you create your own foundational models to make this possible? Can a customer of yours use a third-party foundational model, or are you limited based on the fact that you're going to provide the procedures, you're going to open this up without creating a black box, that it's only your foundational model they can use?
Well, the QLATSIS is in a way a foundational model. It's just a very different kind of foundational model. So the QLATSIS is an algorithm that knows symbolic languages. Like there's a QLATSIS that knows math. There's a QLATSIS that knows predicate logic. There's a QLATSIS that knows Bayesian networks. So a QLATSIS is a foundation model, if you will, that is able to spit out or generate procedures to answer a question. So the way people use our technologies, you need a QLATSIS, and that QLATSIS can be fine-tuned to solve a specific problem. It can also be fine-tuned to work on a specific with a specific symbolic language. If you like it to speak in math, then that's what you teach it. And if you like it to speak in Bayesian reasoning, then that's what you teach it. But the QLATSIS in that sense is a foundation.
But what if I want to use like
the IBM Granite model?
What's your answer to that?
That is also in principle possible, but then you're turning things a little bit around. So we often solve this problem as well. Once you have a black box model, whatever model that is, you can actually use the QLATSIS to create a procedure that mimics whatever it is that black box model does. So once you have it, and that's particularly if you have specifically a predictive model, then you can use whatever data, either synthetic or real data, to generate the behavioral signature of that model, and then you can use the QLATSIS to find procedures that mimic that. So that will be very similar to explainable AI, similar to SHAP or LIME, if you know those kind of approaches. But where the QLATSIS does not translate the model into like feature importance, but instead into an equivalent simple procedure that does the same as the predictive model does, as the black box model does.
So I'm going to ask a silly question here just to make sure I can make the connection, because I'm not familiar with the Q-lattice piece. The Q-lattice algorithm, will it then create its own neural network? Or no, it's purely complementary. Its algorithm is able to identify the procedure that was used and explain it as it's running.
Yes. Yes. And the trick is the Q-lattice is it's a different kind of thing, but it itself consists of a very large number of weights. But those weights do not work in the same way as a neural network. They work in the way that they give probabilities of things being related to each other in the symbolic language that that we're talking about. So if it's a mathematical Q-lattice, then it understands the relationship between things in the real world, or in this case in another model, and what you want to predict, and how that is mathematically related to each other. And it has a bunch of weights that makes that actually a good representation of how these things actually relate. And that means that the Q-lattice can generate procedures that mimic that understanding. So in that sense, the Q-lattice is a source of procedures to answer a question.
It kind of still sounds like it's opening up the black box.
If you use it in this way, you're opening up the black box. You're opening up a predictive model. Okay. So in that sense, what you've done here is you made a Q-lattice that mimic the behavior of a black box model, and then you use that Q-lattice to generate much simpler versions of that black box model. So simple versions that you can understand them. But my point is that you didn't need to have the black box model in the first place. You could have bypassed all that and just taken an appropriate Q-lattice and generated the simple explanation before you ever had the black box model.
Under what scenarios are most of your customers working with your technology today then? I mean, I made the example of you could use IBM Granite models. In the scenario that you describe, you know, how do clients typically work with Ebzu?
Yeah. Our oldest and most still biggest business is in pharmaceutical research. So the situation there is that customers typically have relatively little data about a patient population, like maybe 10 or 100 or 1,000 people who suffer from some rare disease, and they want to understand that disease. Why do these people become sick? And then the Q-lattice will generate explanations for the process that leads the person from moving from healthy to sick, based maybe on their genome or maybe on things you can measure in their blood, serum measurements of various types. So it'll generate an understanding of what causes this disease. And this is an example of where the minimal data requirements are really important, right? Because you can, in many of these situations, it's difficult to get sufficient data on a specific disease. So in some cases, we had as little as 20 patients, and we still were able to come up with new understanding about why these patients became sick. So that's a very common use case, both for science, but also in drug development, where you want to understand the disease so that you can identify ways to intervene with the process and make the patient not become sick, aka a drug. So once you understand the disease, then you want to develop that drug. And here we're more talking about molecular properties. So you have a molecule of some kind, and that molecule is maybe efficient against the disease, but it's also toxic. And now your question is, why is it toxic? And the Q-lattice will then generate a procedure that explains the toxicity of the molecule. So that, and once you understand that, you can design a different molecule that doesn't have that toxicity. So that's very much the case in the life science pharma part of our business. More recently, we've worked a lot in the financial industry, insurance mainly, understanding both risk, the underwriting problem, but also processing claims in situations where the customers need to understand not only that there is a risk related with this underwriting, but actually quantify that in a clear and understandable way in situations where maybe you're insuring a rare object of some kind, so you don't have massive amounts of data. And on the claims processing side, the situation is often that you want to use AI to determine whether a customer can get his money or not, but you have to be able to justify that the decision step by step. And here again, symbolic reasoning is super crucial, because yes, you care about the verdict, money or no money, but you need to be able to explain to regulators and the customer, why do I make the decision that you don't get your money? So these are some of the examples where we work. But I know that people have adopted the QLATs in all sorts of use cases that are like outside of those two, where it's just been adopted by people who have licensed the technology from us and using it for all sorts of things.
In those two examples, thank you for that. Those are good examples. In those two examples, what would be the foundational model that the client would be using?
Well, in the health science, there is no foundational model. It's okay. The QLATs is the only model. You feed the data that you have about the patients to the QLATs, and it delivers an explanation.
So in that scenario, just a database, it just uses the data based on the whatever medical institution is providing you that data, and you can say, all right, we're going to use what you have, and you're just going to use the QLATs on top of that?
Yes, exactly. So the QLATs in question here knows maybe about diseases. So the QLATs itself is trained and has the kind of embedded knowledge of disease understanding. But the specifics of the problem it's solving is provided by the customer, or maybe some public data set about this disease. And then it generates the best hypothesis it can about why do these patients become sick. So there is no other model involved other than the QLATs in these use cases.
But is it a model in of itself then? In other words, tell me a little bit more about that. I think that'll bring clarity into how the QLATs works.
I'll try, but it is where this gets technical. Okay. So the QLATs is essentially a high-dimensional tensor. It's a very large collection of weights that relate concepts and operations on concepts to each other. And it's not three-dimensional or four-dimensional. It's very high-dimensional. It's as high-dimensional as the problem space. So if you're talking genomes, then it's 3 billion-dimensional. And so it understands something about how the human genome relates to diseases. And it is a large collection of numbers, and it is trained, but it's just not trained in a process that's at all equivalent to the way you train a neural network. Because it's fitted on this, it generates like this embedded understanding of how genes relate to diseases in a much wider sense. And then the QLATs is designed in such a way that you can push its button, and then it'll spit out the most likely explanation for a specific disease by sampling these weights that is embedded inside of this high-dimensional space. So
yes, not a neural network, but it's similar to it, kind of. I mean, you're putting weights on, statistical weights.
Yes. It has many of the same. It's designed to do something different, but it's similar in many ways as well.
You know, one thing I often ask, and for Abzu, I'd ask the same thing: what is your secret sauce? It sounds like that is your secret sauce.
Yeah,
it's the QLATs.
Is the magic? It's what we invented, and it's what I founded the company to. I had this crazy thought that it could be done this way, that these ideas from quantum lattice gate simulations would allow us to do symbolic AI in a new and untried way. And it took us a few years to make it work, but Absu's secret sauce is the QLATs.
So, like I said, at IBM, we're doing a lot of explainable AI and symbolic AI. What's your like 1 to 2 minute pitch to them on why they should ring you up and try out Abzu?
Yes. First and foremost, if somebody ever asks you why you made this decision, why did you give credit to this customer? Why did you give this patient medicine but not this one? Why did you accept this request? Why did you reject this other request? If you ever get the why question, then the best way to answer that is to use symbolic AI. It is to know why. Because symbolic AI, if you use symbolic AI, you know why you gave the came up with the decision that you did. That could be internal reasons, or it could be external reasons like compliance or regulators. That's by far the most common reason people turn to us. The second most, but I think maybe as or even more important situation is, I really want to use AI, but I almost have no data. I hear that you can get all of these fantastic results out of AI, but I only have 19 patients, or I only ever did 17 insurance underwritings of this specific type of object in my insurance company's history because it's a rare thing. In those kind of cases, traditional machine learning would do nothing for you. Right? You just can't learn from that little data. But since the QLATS does not learn from data, it creates hypotheses and then it validates them on the data. It flips the entire story around. So you can actually get very good predictive results on very little data. So those are the most common reasons. The need for a clear explanation, very clear explanation that can stand up to any inquiry, and or the need for AI or machine learning in situations where you have relatively or very little or even no data is actually in the limit possible.
Thank you for this. Where can folks reach you and Abzu?
Well, the best, there's lots of ways to get in touch with us. Like we look at our website to see how to get in contact if you are interested in learning more about it. And then me personally, I'm very active on Twitter, or I should say X. So by following C. Wilstrup is the best way to get in real contact with me, because I like to engage in optimistic and positive debates about where AI is taking humanity on the X platform.
But don't you have to engage in the negative to turn it to optimistic?
Yep, that's my mission in life. It's the what are the green spots approach. Like, I know that there are a lot of people who want to clamp down on AI and shut it all down, and let's not do that because of the Terminator thing or whatever. But I'm saying that is not going to solve the problem, friends. It's not going to solve the problem because these things are going to get built. So if we want to have a safer and better AI future, we need to build an alternative that delivers the same value, but in a safer manner. And
well said, well said. Is there anything that I didn't ask that you wish I would have?
That's a good question. You never asked me about the philosophy of mind part. How does consciousness fit into the entire picture?
I actually got a couple. I got a couple questions to end. I would just finish it on Abzu. I always end with a couple questions, and if you don't have an answer to that, if we conquered it, then I'll go to the next question. I think you are the person to ask this question, and that is: are we living in a simulation? Is this the Matrix? You should be the person that could give me that answer.
Yeah, no, we're not living in a simulation. Not if you think of simulation in the sense of a system that was designed by somebody else, in which we are just processes. I don't believe that. But I do believe that we are living in a world that's very different from the world we think we believe in. I believe that how we perceive objective reality is a function of who we are. It's a function of the conscious entities that we humans are. So whenever we think we're studying reality, we're not. We're studying how reality is perceived by conscious entities such as humans, because we cannot step out of ourselves and see the world from outside. So one thing I can say for sure is that we don't live in the world we think we live in. We live in a world that somehow is perceived this way by us. And that's when you get that fully embedded in your thinking, it's a really mind-blowing perspective, because it also means that there are potentials, possibilities, things that can be built, things that can be done that we have not imagined, because we cannot perceive how that can be done yet. The world has many more opportunities than we think. Let's not think that the speed of light really is finite. It's a perceived version of reality. So let's keep exploring the edges of what can really be done in this universe.
So what world are we living in then? I need a drink or maybe even something else for this conversation. It's pretty deep. and I did see your talk, or you gave a snippet. I was doing a little research on, what is it? Panpsychism?
Panpsychism.
Man,
yes.
You kind of probably referred to it just a minute ago, but tell us a little bit more about that so we can really get our mind blown.
Most people assume, for strange reasons actually, that we know the objective world exists, and then we try to explain why human consciousness can arise from this objective world. So we think we know that there's such a thing as mass and light and energy. And then we are surprised by the existence of consciousness, and we try to explain consciousness. How can this possibly arise from mass and energy and light and stuff like that? And that's very difficult to explain. But the funny thing is, we don't know there's such a thing as light or energy or mass. We do know there's such a thing as consciousness, because that's like, that's the the only thing we actually know. We exist. We are here in the world. And another thing we know, but we infer that, is that there are things that appear to be mass, and there are things that appear to be light, and there are things that appear to be energy. We don't know these things exist. We know they seem to exist in our own experience. I'm not saying they don't. That's not what panpsychism is about. It's about acknowledging the what is actually, I'd say, obvious. We know consciousness exists, and from that we deduce that other things seem to exist as well. Now, when we try to explain consciousness from those other things, we're circular. You're suddenly trying to explain consciousness, the phenomenon, based on things that you derived when you took consciousness as a fundamental fact, as an axiom. That cannot be done. You cannot explain consciousness based on things that you derive based on assuming that consciousness exists. It's a circular thing. So panpsychism flips this around and says, right, we know that things are, I know that I'm conscious, and I know that I am made of some kind of matter. I look down at my body here on the couch. Yes, I exist. So somehow matter that appears to me like this needs to have the capability to be conscious. That's a given, right? I know those two things. I seem to exist, be of a lump of meat, and I know that I'm conscious. Ergo, consciousness must be embedded in this lump of meat that appears to be me. And panpsychism just takes that to the extreme. If I am a lump of meat and I'm conscious, then every lump of anything must have some kind of the properties that allows it to be kind of conscious. We call that proto-consciousness. So in panpsychism, you don't think that everything, that a chair is conscious. We think that it has some of the properties that allows it to form consciousness. So what that ultimately means is, like, the simple tenet of panpsychism is that in everything in the universe, there's an embedded property or core that is some kind of proto-consciousness that can combine to form real living consciousness with, like, the experience of self and memory and all those things that are characteristic of human life. A lot of people react to that and say, "Ah, that can't be true," and that's like what mystic stuff. But actually, it's like the most simple, the most parsimonious explanation to fit the things together that we know. So I think the onus, if you want to take the opposite standpoint, that consciousness somehow magically arises from inanimate matter, I think that requires a lot of proof. It's very difficult. Actually, it's impossible, in my opinion. So that's panpsychism.
Wow, man. Consume my entire afternoon here. I'm going to be off. But from the guy that just took time off to learn Sumerian, that's impressive, man. That's good stuff. Where can folks go to get more information on panpsychism, by the way?
Well, my favorite author on the matter is a British guy called Philip Goff. He wrote a book called Galileo's Error a while back. That's a good starting point to understand, like, a popular introduction to panpsychism. Galen Strawson, another famous British philosopher, somewhat older, is also a good starting. He's one of my favorite philosophers. But I would say today, start with Galileo's Error and Philip Goff if you want to get a digestible introduction to the ideas of panpsychism. Or follow me on Twitter.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll do that. I've already read some of your stuff already, and I'm still trying to consume it, to be honest. But what I did get out of this is Elon Musk is wrong. We are not living in a simulation. Yeah. So I'll take that with me.
For sure.
So I always finish with this question, and I'm going to finish with it here. But it looks like you do a lot of this stuff for fun. But my question is just that. What do you do for fun when you're not doing all this stuff?
Well, I have 4 kids, a partner, and a house, and a company, and a lot of weird hobbies. That fills up my time. I also do a bit of sleeping now and then. But my
didn't sound like it, by the way.
well, I think I'm a learner. I love learning. I love reading. I love listening to podcasts. But I also love playing badminton with my son, and taking long hikes. So
a man of the world, Well, you're definitely a learner, one that's learning Sumerian. That's fantastic. Thank you for being here, Casper Wilstrup. Very much appreciative. Learned a lot today. Love what you're doing. We'll put a lot of the contact information in the show notes. But again, thank you for being here.
thank you so much for having me. Wonderful conversation.
And listeners, as always, hit us on almartintalksdata@gmail.com. Let us know what you'd like to hear about. Until next time, we shall see you on the podcast. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.